And we'll move on to our next case, United States versus Larinetta. Mr. Prasad. Ms. Prasad, sorry. Would you wait a second till it quiets down? We won't start the clock running until it does. Okay, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Vinayaka Prasad, counsel for defendant appellant Christopher Larinetta. Your Honors, this case is about unbounded liability, overtaking the sentence that would have been moored in punishment for the offense of conviction. There were three issues briefed for this court, and today I would like to focus on the Fifth and Sixth Amendment issues, as well as the restitution issue. I would like to begin by noting that the Supreme Court relatively recently established a new test for determining Fifth and Sixth Amendment violations. The Apprendi rule, which uses a statutory maximum punishment to test whether a Sixth Amendment violation has occurred, was first recognized only 12 years ago in the year 2000. That rule uses the statutory maximum punishment as a proxy for determining whether a judge's discretion at sentencing has exceeded the bounds of the jury's findings of a specific offense of conviction. Now, the Supreme Court has never suggested that that is the singular rule or the singular proxy for determining that the Sixth Amendment has been violated. But instead, the Court has time and again stated that it would leave due process open to not discreetly define those boundaries and to test judicial discretion on a case-by-case basis. Now, in this case, the Sixth Amendment violation takes a different form, and the form is consecutive sentencing, which resulted in a sentence above the statutory maximum for any single offense of conviction, but without tying the judge's discretion to any elements of the offenses of conviction or any conduct underlying those offenses. Now, the judge's reliance on Section 2G2.2B5 of the United States Sentencing Guidelines in this case exceeded the bounds of the facts underlying the offenses of conviction, thus eliminating a jury's role of determining the offense that can actually be punished.
I'm having a lot of conceptual difficulty with your argument because the sentence in this case was 30 years and the maximum was, I think, 130. So I don't see how we can possibly have an Apprendi violation.
Well, Your Honor, it's not that it's a strict Apprendi violation, but it is a Sixth Amendment violation. Now, yes, all of the offenses stacked together would have a maximum punishment of 130 years.
And the
punishment.
Judge has complete discretion to run the sentences consecutive if he wants to.
Well, I think that that's the question, Your Honor. Does the judge have complete unbounded discretion for any reason under the sun to determine that sentences can run consecutively?
But our problem here is it wasn't for any reason under the sun.
Well, Your Honor,
there were specific categories that added up in terms of the sentencing scheme that put him in a position where when you look at this pattern of activity, when you look at the material portraying sadistic conduct, I mean, there were various things in the sentencing guideline framework that caused those points to total up that caused then the ability to sentence consecutively.
Correct, Your Honor. But if we look at those points as they were added up, if we subtract from those points the pattern of activity enhancement, which is the enhancement that is discussed here that does not relate to the offense of conviction, then we see that the guidelines themselves suggest consecutive sentencing, or concurrent sentencing.
That doesn't matter. The judge could still sentence consecutive. The guidelines are non-binding.
Yes, Your Honor. The judge does not have to follow the guidelines.
What criterion do you suggest for whether a sentence should be consecutive or concurrent?
Well, Your Honor, the federal sentencing statute for concurrent sentencing states that a judge should look at any statutory purposes of sentencing related to the offenses, and that would be the offenses of conviction. And the Supreme Court has previously considered whether consecutive sentencing scheme is permissible.
No. In simple language, please. What do you think should be the criterion for whether to give a consecutive sentence or a concurrent sentence?
If there are differences among the offenses that require different offenses,
I don't know
to be
why.
Separately.
What's the relevance of differences? They're different offenses. Why does that make a difference?
Well, Your Honor,
in concurrent sentencing means basically you're not sentencing for one of the crimes. So when is that the right sort of thing to do?
There are two.
Right. If you have two concurrent 10-year sentences, I mean, if you have two crimes that if there were separate people, be 10 years apiece, and they're committed by the same person, concurrent sentence then would be 10 years, consecutive 20. The concurrent sentence basically wipes out one of the crimes, or you could say sentence each of them half as long as could be. Now, what's the reason for concurrent sentence? Consecutive sentence is very easy to understand because that's how you preserve the punishment for each crime. You don't give a person a credit for having committed multiple crimes. So what is a strong case for wanting to make a sentence concurrent?
I think, Your Honor, if we look at the reasoning for joinder offenses, which is true
just
in this case.
Just give me a simple answer. What's a good reason for a concurrent sentence?
Because
you can give
often
an example or you can give a reason, right?
Often, Your Honor, the separate offenses all are related to each other. They are part of one course of conduct. That's why they have been charged together, and that is why one sentencing judge is viewing them all together. That was true in this case. Every single offense that was charged separately was viewed as one single course of conduct that the defendant engaged in. There was no intervening event, there was no intervening punishment that separated his action in any way. And so concurrent sentencing would address the fact that he is technically.
Also, if you rape a person and then kill her, then there's an argument for concurrent sentences because you committed the crimes as part of the same general course of activity?
I think there would
that
be.
Is that just answer yes or no?
Yes, Your Honor, and there would also.
Well,
be.
I don't get that.
I don't understand.
Why do you treat the rape murderer better because he raped and murdered within a short interval rather than a month apart?
Why does that make
him a better person or less likely to commit crimes in the future?
It's not that you're treating him better, Your Honor, but it is that you're looking
The reason? Why do you want to treat that person? You are treating him better if you give him a concurrent sentence. Why do you want him treat him better than this someone who does the rape and murder with a one-month interval?
Your Honor, you're not treating him better, but you are.
Would you tell
at
me?
Overall.
Well, of course you're treating him better. You're giving him a lighter sentence.
But that's not true, Your Honor, because it's not true that every
defendant. No, you're giving him a lighter sentence.
Your Honor,
because
every.
Listen to me. If he raped in January and murdered the victim 6 months later, you'd say that was a stronger argument for a consecutive sentence. Whereas if he does it within minutes, you say that's an argument for a concurrent sentence. And I'm trying to figure out why you think that.
Your Honor, I think that it is not true that in every case a defendant is actually going to be sentenced to the statutory maximum that is permissible under the offense. When a judge is choosing the overall sentence, it may be that sentences only need to run concurrently in order to choose the sentence that they feel best addresses both the rape and the murder. That is a decision for the judge, and the judge would be looking at the
offense.
So the
interval has nothing to do with it?
No, Your Honor. I think that the judge in that individual case would be looking at the offenses of conviction.
Okay, so we've gotten rid of the interval. We don't care about the interval. But now you're saying the judge might give a concurrent sentence because he thought that the aggregate would be half, say, what it would be if consecutive, is enough. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. And he has the ability to do that. And in fact,
well, apparently this judge didn't think it was enough. So what was his error?
His error, Your Honor, was that he didn't say that concurrent sentencing under the statutory maximum of 20 years imprisonment was not enough for the offenses that the defendant was convicted of. He said that the reason for the consecutive sentencing was his basis on the guideline, which added another 10 years to his sentence for entirely separate conduct. That was not.
And that's that pattern of activity enhancement you're speaking of, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And specifically, that particular enhancement provides for circumstances like these where there are no criminal charges.
Yes, Your Honor. That enhancement has specifically stated that there does not need to be a tie at all. It does not need to be recidivism based on prior convictions. It does not need to be in any way related to the offense that the defendant is currently facing. It doesn't have to include the same minors or be a part of the same course of conduct. Basically, it's saying that we should, at sentencing, determine these facts that have never been alleged before, that the defendant has never received process for before, that the defendant has not been put on notice of by his indictment for this offense.
That happens regularly in guideline sentencing.
Your Honor, I think
conduct is taken into consideration under a variety of different guidelines provisions, and there's judicial fact-finding.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that that was the argument that the government pointed to, specific guidelines that go outside of the elements of the offense. But if we look at those specific guidelines, such as the government had pointed to a gun being used in a drug crime, where the offense of conviction was the drug crime, and then the court has the ability to determine whether the gun was also used, even though that was
Aren't
not charged.
Are you really arguing that he shouldn't have gotten the concurrent or the consecutive sentence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't understand the question.
Well, aren't you really arguing that these other crimes he shouldn't have been convicted of at all?
Well, he was never convicted
no,
of...
No, I mean, he should... So that it shouldn't... It shouldn't have affected his sentence at all. Isn't that your view?
Your Honor, I think that there is... A judge is allowed to consider a defendant and his background, but that discretion to consider that information must act within the Sixth Amendment. And I believe that when a judge decides to add additional punishment outside of what would have been in the realm of punishments based on something that is not part of the offense of conviction, then he is considering something entirely separate that the jury wouldn't have allowed him to consider.
But that's where we get back to this original problem, that this sentence is not outside the realm of the statute. It's well within it and well below the guidelines range, which was life, although I suppose your argument is it would have been less without this five-level enhancement.
Yes, Your Honor. So those two things is one that actually under 3584, which is the federal statute on consecutive sentencing, it does state that sentences will run concurrently unless a judge orders that they should run consecutively. And the reasons for running consecutively are based on the judge considering factors related to the offenses of conviction.
Is that what the statute says?
It does, Your Honor, that it will run consecutively unless the judge orders it to run.
No, I'm asking about the qualifying language that you just added.
Well, Your Honor.
All it does is empower the judge to do it one way or the other. It doesn't place any sort of limitation on that.
Well, it does
discretion,
direct,
does it?
Excuse me, Your Honor. It does direct the judge to consider the statutory purposes of sentencing as to each offense in determining if consecutive sentencing should be used.
Right, but that's vast discretion, it seems to me. That's not a limiting principle that has much force to it.
Your Honor, I think that we read it in conjunction with the Sixth Amendment, which doesn't allow a judge to use any reason under the sun to add additional punishment when a defendant has been convicted of a specific sentence.
Couldn't he have given him the same sentence without consecutive sentences?
No, Your Honor. The statutory maximum facing any single charge for which the defendant was convicted was 20 years.
No, but he was convicted of several different crimes.
Correct, Your Honor. So those sentences would have to be entered consecutively. Some of the charges would have to be entered separately in order to reach a 30-year sentence. If they were all to run concurrently...
I understand.
And, in fact, without the pattern of activity enhancement, which is the only enhancement in the entire guideline, 2G2.2, that goes outside of the offense conduct...
So is your argument that somehow the crimes were not sufficiently related to each other? I don't know why that matters, consecutive or... I mean, if the person, you might give someone consecutive sentences because precisely because all his crimes were different. He was a versatile criminal, robbery, murder, rape, what have you.
Absolutely.
And I'd say this person, I'd say the maximum sentence for each of these is 20 years. This person is so uncontrollable in the variety of his criminal activities that I think his sentences should be consecutive so that he never gets out again. Would that be wrong?
No, Your Honor, and that's exactly what we're advocating for,
fine.
Is that differences among the offenses should be the driving force for consecutive sentencing. If Your Honors don't have any more questions...
Well, I just have one other. Couldn't the district court have sentenced him to 360 months even without the pattern enhancement?
Not under the guidelines, Your Honor. Certainly under the statutory, if all of the various offenses were sentenced on top of each other, it could have come out to 130 years. The guidelines, however, did suggest without the pattern of activity enhancement concurrent sentencing, it did suggest 235 months, which
yeah,
would be
but
under
it,
the...
Yeah, but it was possible that he could have been sentenced to 360 months.
If we stacked all of the sentences,
right.
It would require consecutive sentencing.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you another question. I'm having trouble with the different and similar crimes bearing on this. Suppose you have someone, he's a drug criminal. He only does drugs. And he's constantly being arrested and prosecuted and so on, convicted. All of his crimes are very similar. They're all drug crimes. Couldn't a judge say, I'm going to give you consecutive sentences, because look, you're obviously, this is your career, you're compulsive, no way you're ever going to stop doing this, so I want to throw the book at you and give you consecutive sentences. Would that be okay?
Yes, Your Honor, because the judge would...
So it turns out that whether the crimes are similar or they're dissimilar, there are still considerations that would argue for a consecutive sentence, and why isn't that true in this case?
Because it was nothing about the different offenses of conviction that resulted in the consecutive sentence, Your Honor. It was only this pattern of activity allegation that has never before been a conviction or even a charge against this defendant that resulted in the consecutive sentence.
I would have thought that your answer to Judge Posner's question would have been that the same course of conduct in this case, that is to say your client's possession of child pornography, was chargeable under several different statutes, receipt and possession. And there's not a double jeopardy problem that because there is a slight difference in the elements of the offense, but it's the same conduct, not a continuous course of conduct like the hypotheticals that Judge Posner is positing, but the same conduct is chargeable at the executive's discretion as multiple crimes. And that's okay under the double jeopardy clause. Your argument is it's not okay under the due process clause.
Yes, Your Honor, and we did actually argue to the sentencing judge that he should consider the fact that this was all the same course of conduct, in fact, the exact same conduct in a repetition that was charged under prosecutorial discretion under several different counts of conviction. However, I think that the fact that the judge was given all of those counts of conviction then leaves it to the judge to use his discretion to determine how those sentences should interact with each other. And in this case, it was he improperly used his discretion to suggest that those offenses should not overlap with each other as far as sentencing goes.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Prasad.
Thank
so
you.
We'll hear from Mr. Cassell.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Paul Cassell from the University of Utah Appellate Clinic, here on behalf of two women today that I'll refer to as Amy and Vicky. May it please the Court, the lead argument of both of our adversaries in this case has been that no other circuit has agreed with Amy and Vicky's position. As of 1 hour ago, the landscape dramatically changed. In a 42-page opinion, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals en banc accepted every single argument that Amy and Vicky are advancing in the front of this court. In a 42-page opinion written by Judge Garza, name of the case, it's two consolidated cases, In Re Amy and United States versus Wright. And quoting from the opinion, I apologize for using a cell phone in the courtroom, but obviously important news for Amy and Vicky, the Fifth Circuit said, and I'm quoting here, "We reject the approach of our sister circuits and hold that Section 2259 imposed no generalized proximate cause requirement before a child pornography victim may recover restitution from a defendant possessing images of her abuse." And then the court proceeds to adopt precisely the analysis that we lay out in our intervention brief in this case. Most notably,
well, maybe you could tell us, or tell me anyway, what proximate cause means, since although I've been hearing the term for the last 50-odd years, I don't have any idea what it means.
And I think, you know, and we certainly share your frustration, and we think that is precisely why Congress did not use the term proximate in most of the categories of relief for child pornography victims. It would lead to the frustration of Congress's goal of obtaining full restitution for child pornography victims. Now, for the last subsection of 2259, when the Congress authorized awards for any other losses, Congress presumably thought, well, that's an open-ended situation, and so we're going to require some sort of proximate connection, or that the losses be a proximate result of the defendant's crime.
Is there any cause requirement under any of the other subsections of the statute beyond the catch-all?
Yes, Your Honor. And the Fifth Circuit's en banc opinion lays this out very nicely, adopting the position that we advanced to the Fifth Circuit en banc, and as well in our briefs. 2259C defines the victim of a child pornography offense as someone who has been harmed. So there is a
harmed
harm
as a result of
a child pornography offense.
Right.
2259C, let me make sure I'm quoting the statute precisely here.
As a result of is but-for causation requirement language, right?
Harmed as a result of, that is, but-for causation of the commission of a crime under this chapter, that is, a child pornography offense. How does that work? You have a concrete illustration in front of you, what the district court judge did very carefully in this case. The district court judge received detailed submissions from Amy and Vicky that itemized primarily psychiatric expenses for the course of their lifetime, lost future income over the course of their lifetime. The district court judge made a factual finding, not challenged by either side, that the submissions were persuasive and thorough. And having looked at those persuasive and thorough submissions, concluded that $4.3 million was the totality of the losses that were involved here. The difficulties...
But for means cause or means harm to the victim as a result of the defendant's commission of a crime. So you've got to link that to the defendant.
We do have to link it to the defendant, but we do not have to trace out every little aspect of the loss. And let me give you a very concrete illustration. Amy and Vicky go regularly to psychiatric counseling to deal with the fact that there are defendants like Larinetta looking at their pictures. Let's assume that they go for 1 hour and the bill is $100. They don't sit down and from 1 o'clock to 1:05 talk
course,
about Mr.
Of course,
Larinetta.
Not. Nobody's requiring that. But what level, what kind of but-for causation is at issue in a crime like this, where you have child victims of rape,
right?
Whose images are put out over the internet, and the defendant in this case is a receiver and possessor of those.
And a
images.
Distributor in this case as well.
And a distributor in this case. So he's got some culpability. What is his level of but-for culpability before we get to this issue of proximate cause?
Right. And let me make clear. Maybe I need to highlight the fact that the district court found that there was indeed harm here. And that finding has not been challenged by Larinetta on this case. So it's not in front of the court. But what the district court found in this case is that the losses, the $4.3 million, all resulted from the fact that these were victims, Amy and Vicky, of child pornography offenses. That why were they going for psychiatric counseling? Because there were people out there, like Mr. Larinetta, that were looking at pictures of them.
He created or contributed to the creation of a market for these images.
Yes.
And so he is responsible in the eyes of the law as a matter of but-for causation. But generally, in a situation like this, it would be only for the incremental contribution that he makes to the ultimate harm, not for the whole thing.
That's where I would respectfully disagree, and I think the Fifth Circuit would respectfully disagree with the way that you formulated the issue for this reason. We have a situation that's a classic problem in tort law. Let's assume
suppose he actually has $4.3 million, and suppose, since he's the only potential defendant with any money, you just go after him and get the $4.3 million.
Yes.
Doesn't he have a right of apportionment?
He would have a right to seek contribution. The Seventh Circuit, this Court, has held exactly that twice, U.S. versus Flashburger and U.S. versus Balint. The Fifth Circuit en banc an hour ago also said that there would be.
But your argument is that you, that Amy and Vicky, they can go after any of the joint tortfeasors. They can get full damages or whatever he can afford. But they're not required to establish his incremental effect on their welfare.
Precisely.
So they're in the standard joint tortfeasor.
It's standard tort principle, and that's why the Fifth Circuit en banc just recently rejected the D.C. Circuit's decision in Monzel. Monzel said tort principles require victims to tease this out. That is not true when you have a situation where there is a single indivisible injury.
That's true in the case where two or more causes by themselves would have produced the harm, and you can't tease out which one did it.
That's right.
Two gunshots that hit the victim at the same time, either one of which would have been fatal. That's an indivisible harm that both tortfeasors are jointly and severally liable for. That's not the situation we have here. This defendant's viewing of these images, as reprehensible as it was, was neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for the injuries here. It was just an incremental contribution to it. It made it worse at a certain increment.
With all respect, Judge Sykes, we respectfully disagree. When Larinetta viewed the images of Amy and Vicky being bound, raped, and sodomized as young girls, that was a gross invasion of their privacy that triggered the need for them to go to psychiatric counseling. Now, it is true there are other people around the world who are also looking at their images. And so if Larinetta were out of the picture, then they would also have to go to psychiatric counseling. But if those other people were out of the picture, the fact that he alone viewed those images would have forced them to seek psychiatric counseling, would have made it difficult for them to go to college. Both of these young women have dropped out of school because of their difficulty in interacting with the public. That is because of defendants like Larinetta who are viewing these images.
Yes, but that's right. Defendants like him, yeah. But there has to be more than one.
One is enough.
One isn't going to cause the 4.3 million. I mean, unless these women are, you know, really hypersensitive.
Your Honor, let me press that point just briefly. In this case, the district court was given a choice of all or nothing. Larinetta said the proper damages are zero. The government and Amy and Vicky said 4.3 million. So you're saying, well, maybe there's some intermediate cause. That was not what the district court was presented with. Now, we could reformulate the case, reconstruct it, come up with new theories, but that would be unfair to the district court and certainly unfair to Amy and Vicky.
There's nothing about it. No, forget unfairness. The problem, I mean, Judge Sykes is down. The problem, you get these problems in other situations as well. I mean, you could have a whole bunch of factories, say, they're dumping stuff, and it poisons a stream.
Yeah.
But each factory's contribution itself would be negligible, right?
That's right.
Then the question is, do you make someone whose impact was negligible liable for enormous damages, far beyond what he caused? Or on the other hand, do you place the plaintiff in the difficult or sometimes impossible position of having to join a bunch of tortfeasors. Doesn't seem to be a very satisfactory solution.
Well, and let's take exactly your case. We cite in our briefs United States versus Michie, which is the air polluters that all come together causing harm and nobody can disaggregate it. The result in that case, the Sixth Circuit said, was that each of the polluters is on the hook for 100% of the damages. And that is exactly what Congress did
here. But really what we have is a regulatory system for dealing with pollution because we realize the tort system doesn't work. And you could imagine a similar system. Another thing that worries me about this is opportunistic restitution seekers, right? This is one of these unusual situations where it's possible for the victim or alleged victim to generate her own damages, right?
No.
You say, wait, I'm terribly upset. I have to go to a therapy, you know, or I can't work because I'm so upset about knowledge that these ugly pictures of me have been seen by people, right? How do you ever determine whether that's just, you know, making money out of the legal system or whether there's genuine injury or how grave it is. Right?
The same way that we decide restitution issues around this country every day. A district court hears
and it's
the
a
evidence.
Really bad system, right? No one thinks
it is a system that Congress.
No one thinks the courts are any actually good at determining, you know, psychological damage from pictures. Who knows? How do you prove something like that?
The district court made a fact.
Someone comes in and testifies, says, "I'm so upset at the thought of people seeing these pictures of me that I can't work." What do you do with that?
What you
Practical
do?
Practical matter.
What you do is what Amy and Vicky did in this case, and I, with all respect, would plead with you to read the 50-page victim impact statements that both Amy and Vicky submitted to the district court. In those victim impact statements are not only their own sworn declarations about what happened.
The lawyers write these things, right? They make them very moving. And undoubtedly, look, people differ greatly in their psychological fragility, and I'm sure there are some people who are really damaged by this pornography, and Amy and Vicky may very well be those people. I'm not questioning that. I don't know anything about it. But there is a danger for the legal system as a whole in getting engulfed in claims of this sort. They've appeared in hundreds of cases already, haven't they?
Believe me, they do not want to be in hundreds of cases.
They've appeared in hundreds of cases, haven't they?
Yes.
And they've collected a large amount of money already, haven't they?
They've collected roughly, in Amy's case, half of the damages that she's seeking. In Vicky's case, it's somewhat less.
That's maybe millions of dollars. Look, when you have opportunities to make millions of dollars in the legal system, you have a danger of abuse, right? I think the judges have to weigh that against the wanting to provide a remedy for these people.
With all due respect, you do not have to weigh that, Your Honor. That is a decision for Congress. Congress passed a law that commanded the courts to give the full
but
amount
Congress
of the losses.
Didn't resolve these causality issues.
Congress passed a law that said if there are difficulties, those difficulties will be borne by the wrongdoer. Criminals like Larinetta, let them run around the country in courts all over this nation trying to sort out what the damages are. But when Amy and Vicky put in persuasive...
But isn't there something a little strange? I mean, suppose he looked at these pictures once and he didn't like them. His tastes run to different forms of child pornography. He didn't like it. He just looks at them once. And meanwhile, you have out there, you have whoever created the pictures in the first place. You may have people who uploaded them to the internet and distributed them all around the world, you know. So there are very different levels of culpability, and none of that gets reflected, right?
By choice of Congress. Congress said that
did not deal with the issue in this case.
With all due respect, it did.
No,
it said in Section 2259 that women like Amy and Vicky are entitled to recover, and I'm quoting here, the full amount of their losses from criminals like Larinetta.
So going back to the case that was decided just a few hours ago, were they the same kind of circumstances that we have here where they were raped before by other people? And
I argued the case in the Fifth Circuit, making the same arguments there that I'm making this afternoon on behalf of the same client, Amy. So it's identical facts, identical victim impact submissions, and nine judges on the Fifth Circuit agreed that she's entitled to $3 million in restitution.
Were you before the Fifth Circuit on mandamus or intervention?
On mandamus, and indeed the Fifth Circuit found that it was clear and indisputable error for the district judge not to award mandatory restitution. The Fifth Circuit emphasized that this is not a discretionary decision for judges to balance different things. Congress used the word mandatory three times in 2259.
So then, with respect to Vicky and Amy, should we rule in their favor, and it would be that amount? And should the same thing occur in the First Circuit, you know, you'd be arguing for the same amount. Your position would be, even if that amount ran into the hundred millions of dollars, it doesn't matter because Congress says it's mandatory, and so therefore the fix needs to be in Congress and not something that the courts tamper
with. Right, and let me be clear. We're not seeking anything more than the full amount of her damages. Once Amy receives all of the lost
income. Does Larinetta have any assets?
Larinetta, as I understand it, is in the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program and is paying whatever it is, $25 a quarter towards this.
So let me just understand this. So
he pays $100 a year toward this judgment? Is that
That's
the
right.
idea?
So in terms of finite damages, are you saying, you know, in each case when this has occurred and they're violated because things are on the Internet, then they can collect up to, if you value, say, their damages being, say, $10 million, that once that $10 million amount has been met, whether it's from a case in the First Circuit or the Second Circuit or whatever, that was the amount of the damages. So you're not trying to collect duplicative damages.
Exactly. And the Justice Department, in their brief, indicates that they keep careful records of all these. We also keep careful records. We could provide that to the court if the court would find it helpful as to precisely how much damages they've recovered.
How many of these defendants are there floating around?
Hundreds. At this point, for example, Amy has received 1,600 notices that her images were found in federal cases. And that's why you should reject the suggestion of the government that you chop this up by each and every little case. The amount of money that Amy and Vicky then would be getting in each case would become trifling. District courts all over this country would then have to be assessing awards
of
$200.
How many people's pictures appear in child pornography? Of child pornography that's been seen or created by persons who've been convicted.
I'm not sure I'm understanding exactly what your question is. I mean, Amy and Vicky.
Well,
how many
people are there in their position? They have been.
There are hundreds that are out there potentially. Although many of these victims do not have legal counsel, as you know, I'm here today pro bono.
Not yet.
That's right. But if you're worried, you seem to be worried that somehow people are going to collect.
I'm worried. I'm surprised you say hundreds. I would think thousands of women would have had pictures. Maybe they're largely foreign. I don't know.
But sadly,
you think
many
it'd be more
of them,
than hundreds of Americans who were in their position.
But sadly, many of those women cannot be identified. It's only because Amy and Vicky were identified through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and were notified then through legal counsel that they're able to appear in front of this court and others and seeking restitution. Many other women are struggling with the psychiatric costs that are imposed by crimes like these, but they do not have legal counsel that make it possible for them to present the kinds of restitution requests that are persuasive to the district court. If you think that these women were collecting too much money, you should remand to the district court for making clearly erroneous findings. But even Larinetta has not challenged a penny of the amount that these women were awarded. The only thing he's challenged.
Well, why should he? He has no real stake in this. He's not going anywhere, and he can spare his $25.
Well, he's challenged the proximate cause, but my point is he has not challenged the calculation of the amount.
You know, his stake is very limited in this restitution.
He's going to pay $2,500 over the course of serving 25 years in prison, and then after that he will have a substantial restitution obligation that will remain overhanging. I mean,
it is true.
But the reason we're pressing this point so strongly is that a small number of wealthy defendants are where the money is in this case. And if you adopt the principle urged by the government, the net result is going to be that Vicky and Amy and countless other women like them will never receive, and again I'm quoting here, the full amount of the damages that Congress has promised them. We ask you to enforce this.
You said the safeguard is that amount is an identifiable, ascertainable amount, even though someone might challenge what that amount is.
Right.
And because it's being kept track of, you don't have a situation of duplicative awards that exceed whatever that amount is.
And the ultimate safeguard here, Judge Williams, is the district court judges of this country. The district court judge in this case looked at the submissions that Amy and Vicky presented, looked at any arguments that Larinetta wanted to raise against them, and made a factual finding that they have suffered $4.3 million in losses. And that factual finding is not challenged on appeal. So I would ask you to follow the reasoning of the Fifth Circuit and affirm the judgment below.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Cassell. And Ms. Ralston?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Sonia Ralston for the United States. I'd like to touch briefly on the sentencing issue before turning to the intervention question and then to restitution. On the sentencing issue, I'd like to point the Court's attention to Guideline 2G, 1.2D, which the district court followed here and which deals precisely with the consecutive sentencing issue that the defendant went on about. It instructs the district court to group the offenses, so it deals with the multiple charging question, and then to develop the total appropriate sentence for all of the relevant conduct, and then to impose the sentence partially consecutively if necessary. That's a reasonable way of doing it. It's what the district court did here, and it should be affirmed. And multiplicity and double jeopardy challenges, when they're applicable, deal with any constitutional concerns that are relevant. Now I'd like to turn to something that Judge Sykes picked up on, which is that the Fifth Circuit joined all the other circuits to have ever addressed this question, held that the victims are only ever allowed to appear in a criminal case by way of mandamus or as amicus. In this case, they have asked to intervene, and the court granted their motion for intervention, but said this panel...
Why shouldn't they be allowed to intervene?
Because to allow them to intervene gives them full rights as a party, which makes unclear exactly where the adversarial relationship is.
Well, no, their rights are limited to what they're seeking. They can't intervene in order to prosecute and try to convict the defendants. That wouldn't be proper. They're just intervening to press their monetary claim. What's wrong with that?
Well, if Your Honor is referring to their rights under the Crime Victims' Rights Act, that act provides for one remedy, and that remedy is mandamus in the Court of Appeals. It's a motion in the district court followed by mandamus if the motion is denied. That sole remedy was implemented by Congress after much consideration of this question, where victims' rights groups asked for a right of intervention and Congress denied them. All the courts to have considered it have held that determination in the CVRA.
But this is different. I mean, you did, obviously, although you could imagine rejecting this, because in England, for example, victims prosecute criminal cases against their injurers. But clearly, the victim can't intervene because, you know, he's angry at the defendant, wants to make sure the government really does a tough job prosecuting. That I understand. But when you're talking about a financial claim that you have that depends critically on the outcome of the criminal case, why isn't there a strong argument for intervention? I mean, is there a practical difficulty?
There are practical difficulties, but just to be clear, the Third Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit...
Yes, I'm not interested in that. I asked you about practical difficulties.
Yes, Your Honor. When you give someone rights as a party, then they can do things that a party can do that an amicus can't, like petition for rehearing or certiorari. And that should be rights that adhere only to the parties in a case. And in a criminal case, under the Constitution of this country, the government represents the people in criminal cases, including the victims. And the victims, if they have something different to say, we welcome their appearance as amicus.
In a civil case also, the lawyer represents the party, but an intervener, someone who has a financial stake that can be adversely affected by the judgment, in a civil case, is normally allowed to intervene. Now it turns out, in this case, maybe there'll be others like them, these would-be interveners have a very substantial, well, maybe not very, they have certainly a substantial interest in the outcome, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And
so, and the government doesn't. So why shouldn't they be?
I disagree that the government doesn't have a substantial interest in ensuring that the laws are appropriately enforced. But moreover, the civil rules provide an explicit mechanism for intervention, and the criminal rules don't. In Colonatus, in 2007, this court relied on that distinction in a restitution case, in a criminal case.
But do you think if there were no intervention rule, that would mean that people couldn't intervene in federal cases? I think intervention predates the federal rules of civil procedure. I don't think it's true that every procedure has to be in the federal rules in order to be within the power of a federal court.
Federal courts, including...
Like obviously not, since judges are constantly exercising inherent powers, sanction people, and so on. You don't need a rule for everything.
In civil cases, courts only allow intervention under the rule for intervention.
Because there is a rule, right. But if there were no rule, there'd be a judge-made rule about intervention.
But the courts who have considered the question have uniformly determined that it's not allowed in criminal cases.
But why? That's what I'm pushing at. So what you're saying is going to gum up the works because you're going to have victims asking for, you know, cert and all this. That I understand. But the difference here is that there is this discrete, you know, separate financial interest of the plaintiff. And all Amy and Vicky want to protect is their financial interest. They're not interested in any other dimension of the case.
And the CVRA provides for that. If they're dissatisfied with the judgment of the district court, for example, on remand in this case, then they have a right to seek mandamus at this court. The statute provides them a specific mechanism for seeking redress, and it's been used by them, as Professor Cassell just told you. And other courts have considered restitution requests by victims to intervene to appeal a case where the government and the defendant don't want to appeal, and those courts have uniformly rejected intervention.
But is it the ordinary limitation on mandamus that you have to prove not only no alternative remedy, but some gross error on the part of the district court?
Yes, Your Honor. But courts, they haven't had any trouble finding no alternative remedy because they say the statute specifically makes mandamus the only available remedy. And then they do require clear error for a reversal.
I suppose there's a fairly large practical consequence of a general intervention rule for victims in criminal cases, that it would really gum up the works of plea bargaining.
Yes, Your Honor. Both the government and the defendant have a substantial interest in finality of cases, including finality of district court judgments on appeal, finality of appellate judgments against rehearing. And those interests, because our Constitution vests the rights of the people in the criminal process in the government should be able to speak with one voice and resolve those cases. I'd like to turn to the restitution issue, which I think is the main event here today, and note that the proximate cause limitation is necessary because...
Well, what is it?
It's the foreseeable consequence of the defendant's offense of conviction.
That's in addition to cause in fact.
Yes, Your Honor. There needs to be some kind of cause in fact, but... The cause in fact here flows from the thousand cuts rationale, that when a myriad of tortfeasors act independently to cause small injuries to the victim, but each is a distinct injury resulting in a single indivisible loss, for example, a death of the victim, then they are each liable for a portion of that loss. Some courts make them liable for the entirety of the loss. We think the better solution, the more modern solution, is to employ a divided amount of the loss.
And so the statutory requirement of proximate cause operates as a limitation, a further limitation on that measure of causation?
Yes, Your Honor. An example is, I think, illustrative. If you read the first five categories of loss, the first one under 2259B3A is medical services relating to physical, psychiatric, or psychological care. There's no proximate cause limitation in the statute, then the victim who is sexually abused at one point in their life develops cancer 20 years later, completely unrelated. They have medical costs, and they can seek them in restitution.
That would be knocked out at cause in fact, not proximate cause.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Not if you read the statute the way Professor Cassell wants you to. Because
right. Well, there's some conceptual confusion here in that everybody seems to be putting all their focus on proximate cause when there's a real important cause in fact element of the right to restitution here that is important, and people have kind of neglected in the briefing before we even get to proximate cause. Proximate cause is not a term of expansion. It doesn't expand but-for causation. It limits it in standard tort law. So
yes,
you've got to have cause in fact first. That's basic. And then the legal concept of proximate cause may come in to remove highly extraordinary cases from the chain of causation, but we don't get there until we have but-for cause.
Let's go back to the causation. I'm surprised you say that somehow requiring each victim to prove the incremental effect of the defendant's conduct on her welfare is sort of the modern way to do things, and contribution, requiring each tortfeasor to bear liability for the whole but can seek contribution from the other tortfeasors, is somehow not modern. It's the reverse. Contribution is relatively new, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I haven't had the chance to read the Fifth Circuit's decision yet, but it will be the first decision allowing contribution.
But why not? I don't understand. It's simpler that way. That way, the victims can go after the affluent, which apparently Vicki and Amy have done, so they collect a lot of money. So you go after the affluent tortfeasor, get all you can from that person, and then he can turn around and try to mitigate his loss by seeking contribution from the other tortfeasors. Why isn't that the more efficient system?
Because there is no right of contribution in federal law, and there is no right for...
What do you mean, no right of contribution in federal law?
Because there's no statute that provides a cause of action for contribution.
Well, neither is there in, admiralty, but it's the rule. The federal courts recognize contribution.
Only in diversity cases under state law, where the state law provides for the contribution, which... one, varies by state law, and two, to the best of our
research. So are you saying federal courts cannot recognize a right of contribution without a statute?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what.
Where would that come from?
Northwest Airlines. It's a Supreme Court case from 1981. It's cited in our briefing.
Mm-hmm.
And it discusses contribution in a 1983 action, a civil action, actually, under federal law. It says there's no statute, and the court can't make one up out of common law. It recognizes a difference between admiralty law, where there is a federal common law, and other federal issues like Title VII in 1983, where there is not. And it says there is no federal right of contribution, so you can't...
But there's certainly federal common law outside of the admiralty area.
Yes, Your Honor, but not in this context. And it may be in our reply brief to...
Pardon?
It may be in our reply brief to Vicki and Amy's brief, where we discuss this more at length.
But certainly if there was a viable joint and several liability theory, there could be contribution, because that's true in the criminal law. But it's a different name. But there would be essentially contributions, or you would divide up the amount of harm that each, quote, defendant used. Here we don't have multiple defendants.
Yes, Your Honor. But so 3664H is... interesting in that it, for one, only applies to a single case where there are multiple defendants available by its own terms. But secondly, it's not necessarily a right of contribution, as it is that the court orders the liability against all of the defendants, and once one of them has paid it, another one doesn't have to. And that's exactly what happened in the Ballant case, which
saying is that has the effect of contribution.
Not necessarily.
In a sense, I mean, I realize that there are different terms and it's kind of semantical, but the bottom impact.
No, actually, I think the Ballant case is a good example. So in that case, you had six defendants all convicted of a single joint action conspiracy where they were blocking the entrance to an abortion clinic. They were ordered to pay some $1,700 in restitution to the fire department that had come and, like, cut them out of the cages they'd built for themselves. And one of the defendants paid the order in full. Two of the other defendants paid nothing and had sought to appeal their sentence. This court held that the case was moot because they would never have to pay anything because it had been paid by one of their co-defendants. It then kind of opines in a footnote that contribution might be available under Wisconsin law, but that's in no sense a holding, and it wasn't even really raised.
So does the Justice Department oppose contribution because it would confer a benefit on a defendant in some cases?
It's not that we, I think oppose is the wrong.
Because, of course, that wouldn't be correct, since it would benefit, denying contribution benefits other defendants, right?
Yes.
So does it, what's the government's interest in this issue?
Our interest is in accurately applying the law, the statutes as they're written.
No, I mean your interest as the Justice Department and responsible for prosecuting these people. What interest do you have in whether there's contribution or non-contribution or a foreseeability requirement or non-foreseeability requirement?
Our interest is ensuring that the sentences all defendants receive are just and are reasonable under the law as it's written for...
What would be unjust about a contribution right?
Well, there isn't one, and
right.
The Supreme Court has said you can't invest
one. What would be unjust? You say you have an interest in justice, but I don't see how that's engaged with these issues of contribution, causality. Anyway, forget that. What about, okay, so you're defining proximate cause as foreseeability. That's fine. So what's the foreseeability problem with these cases? I mean, I suppose if you're a pornographer and you distribute these pictures, you know it's possible that the person whose picture it is will learn about this and be harmed, and so what? So what's unforeseeable?
The extent of the harm, I think, is unforeseeable.
No, but one thing basic in tort law, you don't have to know the amount of the harm, right? That's the eggshell skull rule.
So I want to distinguish between the injury and the loss. The injury, the violation of privacy and...
No, the loss is the injury. Loss is the injury. Now, you can't, in this case, they've monetized the injury by looking at lost wages and expensive psychiatric treatment and so on. There may be psychological harms in addition, you know, like pain and suffering, which we also allow, maybe not in restitution. I don't know. But what's the problem? You know, if you're in this business, pornography business, that you may cause psychiatric damage, which will in turn lead to expenditures on psychiatric care, maybe loss of employment and so on. You know that. What more do you have to foresee in order to be liable for your torts?
There's something I think we need to clarify about the...
It's like saying, I ran down this person in my car, but I didn't know that he was, you know, weak, abnormally weak, and he was killed. A normal person I'd hit with my car wouldn't have been killed, so I shouldn't be liable for his damages. That clearly is not the law.
No,
so why should this be different?
It's the thousand cuts principle, that each defendant who views these images, and the defendant here was only found to have possessed Amy's and Vicky's images. He was convicted of distribution and receipt, but not of their images.
Thousand cuts rule, otherwise known as incremental harm rule, is a common law rule?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a background.
That part of the common law imported, but not the contribution part.
The background principle of tort law that Congress legislated against, yes, but when Congress passed this legislation, it was already clear that there was no federal cause of action for contribution. The statute was passed more than 15 years
ago. Right, there's no federal thousand cuts rule either. It's all state law. So you're asking for a partial importation of tort law.
The question, the statute doesn't explicitly speak to a situation like this. And so the question, I think, becomes, what did Congress intend? And when you're asking that question, the background against which it legislated is useful.
That's meaningless. There's no congressional intent here. Not with respect to such an esoteric question as how foreseeable must the damages be. But why is it you want to introduce this? What, you have to be able to foresee how much money these people will spend, or what? What is it that has to be foreseen?
This, the defendant, had been the only one to act. There's, I think, no plausible way the damages would be what they are. The proximate cause limitation is a recognition that the loss
we were talking about foreseeability. Now, one thing you foresee if you're in this business of pornography, especially he distributed, right? So he uploaded this stuff. So he contributed to the number of pictures that were circulating. So he could foresee that some of these people in the pictures might incur substantial costs as a result. And he's contributing to this. So it's entirely foreseeable. He can't foresee the extent, and his own contribution is limited. That goes back to your argument that there should be some divisibility computation at the outset to determine how much liability. But I don't see where there's a foreseeability problem.
I need to be crystal clear that the defendant did not distribute Amy's and Vicky's images, and his distribution is in no way relevant to the restitution award here. I think all this court needs to know to determine the outcome of this case is that the district court ordered the liability joint and several under 3664H, and it couldn't do that.
Right, but if I could paraphrase what I think your argument is as to the meaning of foreseeability or the meaning of proximate cause here, it's not just limited to foreseeability, although that's what's been briefed. You're really arguing for a disproportionality principle, that this defendant ought to be held responsible only for his proportion of the harm as measured against all of the other offenders who have thus far been caught. That's basically your argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we ought to take the total damages and divide by 180 or whatever it is to date, however many identified viewers of Amy and Vicky's photos are out there.
That's our suggested method.
Okay, and how is that linked to a common law idea of proximate cause or a statutory idea of proximate cause or anything else in the statutory scheme?
Our belief is that that's the fairest way to administer the restitution system, to provide the victims with the full amount of their loss, so that
judicial policy making and nothing having to do with congressional intent.
Is it a feasible burden to place on this people? To identify everybody, count up all the people who saw the pictures?
So the burden. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has a database of identified victims. It sends the notices when the images are found in a case that's being investigated. And then those notices allow for the victims to file their restitution papers. And that's what we're tracking, is because that's when you have a judicial finding that specific images were possessed, distributed, or received by a particular defendant is in restitution proceedings.
And here the defendant possessed them, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not distributed?
Yes, Your Honor. And the district court made a finding of possession, and that's not been disputed.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms.
Thank you.
Ms. Ralston. And Ms. Prasad, I think your time had expired, but if you have anything further you'd like, you can have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to start, actually, by answering Your Honor's question about the eggshell plaintiff and explain how this is a different situation. The eggshell plaintiff is one who has some latent underlying issue that, when faced with a cause, he has greater harm than would be foreseeable. That isn't the case here. This individual was already harmed by the time Mr. Larinetto was ever involved in viewing Amy's and Vicky's pictures. The cause of the harm is something that predates Mr. Larinetta ever acting in any way in relation to Amy's and Vicky's harms. And the question of dividing their harms, I think we move ahead a little too quickly by looking at the total harm or total loss that they have requested, which most definitely includes loss that is caused by their original abuse and by the original availability of their pictures on the Internet, which was also made possible by their original abuser. The amount that is actually added by defendants who may, through infinity, be viewing these pictures is a very different question. Amy and Vicky have suggested that there is a certain amount of loss already imparted upon.
Well, what would you think that they'd have to prove in order to get a monetary judgment against your client?
They would For example, I think there are a few individuals that Amy and Vicky actually point to. Vicky talked about individuals who possessed her picture and then attempted to contact her. Certainly that would be a cause of direct harm upon Vicky. There were other individuals who found out her true identity and discussed her on the internet, and they also possessed her images. Certainly,
so you're saying that she shouldn't have been able to get a judgment against Larinetta?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the facts that were given to the district court, there was no relationship between Mr. Larinetta and any of the harms that they described.
He didn't show the pictures to anybody else?
No, Your Honor. Right, he was only found to possess those pictures.
Right. Well, your position is the fact that he viewed them. I mean, the fact that he viewed them, that would be the only discrete harm to them, the fact that they had knowledge that he had them on his computer.
Correct.
And saw them.
And if his acts were to be aggregated with any other similarly situated defendants, it would be aggregated with those defendants who are viewing their pictures, not with their original abuser or with anyone else making their pictures available on the internet, because that's simply not the similar person who he's acting with. And that makes it different from also the polluters case that the court mentioned earlier, because in that case, all polluters have done a similar act. They have similarly polluted that river, and so then they are similarly liable. In this case, Mr. Larinetta is clearly not similarly liable to a myriad of other actors.
So your position is he shouldn't be ordered to pay any restitution at all, or ordered to pay some nominal amount?
If he were to be ordered to pay some amount, Your Honor, under 3664E, that would be the government and the victim, their burden to show what amount he could be held responsible for. And that was why Mr. Larinetta disagreed with the court's calculation, because there was no evidence as to what he could be held responsible for. And the court actually itself simply stated that it refused to come up with any number because it found any number to be arbitrary.
So if he was in a category, let's say his situation was he was a distributor, he would be put in the class of, say, all the distributors who distributed their photos, their images on the internet. And then there could be some finding of the harm, and that could be somehow apportioned. But that's not your situation.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Ms.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Cassell, would you like a minute? Do you have anything further? Or you don't have to.
You know,
it's up to you.
That's a question to ask a law professor. I mean, if you're giving me an extra minute. Let me just highlight, I think, in response to what Counsel for Larinetta is saying and the government is saying. This case does come to the court with a record, and the record is a factual finding from the district court. These two women suffered $4.3 million in loss. And a but-for causation finding was made in the district court, if you read through the sentencing transcript, not challenged by Mr. Larinetta. Under basic principles of appellate briefing, we briefed the proximate cause question because the other issues have already been resolved in our favor in the district court and are not contested here. On the proximate cause issue, I would commend the 42-page opinion from the Fifth Circuit and ask you to follow it here.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cassell, and thank you to all counsel.